Hello and welcome to Ask an Astronomer. I'm Alex Clark and I'm here with Ian McDonald, who's going to answer your questions. First question is from Yoda the Oak. I'm trying to get my head around the production of metals from a star to the ring on my finger. If stars, when exploding, produce metals and other complex elements, do we know how much metal a star could make just from its light emitted? Is there a process from exploding star to planets?
Well, the story of how you get metals from the heart of a star to the ring on your finger is a complicated one. It's actually the very story I'm trying to piece together at Jodrell Bank. See, most jewellery is made up of the transition metals in the periodic table, which astronomers consider to be heavy elements. These elements are heavier than iron, and there's two kinds of star in which these are made. About half the heavy elements get produced when a massive star undergoes a supernova explosion at the end of its life. These are known as the R-process isotopes, and the other half are made during the final phase of the life of slightly smaller stars, like the Sun, or a few times the mass of the Sun, and they're referred to as the S-process isotopes. Now, depending on which element your ring is made out of, it may have come from either kind of star. For example, iron, gold, silver, and platinum are typically formed in supernovae, while copper and the various silicate mixtures that you find in gemstones come mostly from lower mass stars. And some elements, like the carbon and diamonds, come from both kinds of star. But wherever it comes from, it has to get out of the star. And in the case of smaller stars, the star slowly shakes itself apart during the asymptotic giant branch phase, spreading dusty seeds throughout the galaxy, a bit like a giant puffball, before becoming a planetary nebula. In the case of larger stars, which have to be at least 8 times larger than the Sun, the star runs out of fuel, collapses under its own gravity, and then violently explodes, hurling its innards out into space in a supernova explosion. Now, we can work out what the star has created by taking a spectrum of the material it's thrown off. For smaller stars, we can do this while the star's still alive, by looking at the elements and molecules which condense in the wind that flows out from the star. But in either case, we can do a post-mortem of the star, and look at the planetary nebula or supernova remnant that it's left behind. The spectrum of each of these remnants is composed of a series of lines or bands, and the wavelength of light that these are found at correspond to a particular element or molecule. And the strength of these lines tells us how much of each element there is. But this doesn't tell us about every element. Some elements don't have strong lines at wavelengths that we can easily access from Earth. Gold, silver, and platinum are among these because they're so rare, and as a result of that, they're rarely measured in stars. For these elements, we have to use models. These models are based on a combination of nuclear theory and theories of stellar structure. They model the entire life of the star, and they work out where the elements are produced and when, and how they are released. And if these models can be tuned to match the abundance of the elements that we see, and the abundance of the elements in the solar system, then we can work out how much there is of the ones that we can't see. Once these newly produced elements leave the star, they're spread across the host galaxy. Some work their way into dense clouds of matter that collapse and form stars, and some of those atoms may end up in planets around that star. Some of those atoms may end up on the surface of a planet with life, which is either intelligent or stupid enough to go around digging it up, and some of those atoms might be forged into a ring to go on a finger. But it's perhaps a little curious that a ring, which is often the symbol of a permanence of a union between two people, should be forged in the death of something as apparently constant as a star.
Very interesting. That's a great answer there. So the next question comes from Philippe Lariche, and they say, please can you explain why cosmologists and GR gurus get so upset about information being lost as stuff falls into a black hole? Why can't they just treat it like spilt milk? It's gone. Get over it.
Well, if only it were that easy. Information's a bit like energy. Quantum mechanics dictates that it can't be entirely copied, and it can't be entirely destroyed. It can be sort of copied through quantum entanglement, and it can be garbled up so much that it can be all but destroyed. But if you were omniscient, and could deconstruct everything into its purest waveform, you should still be able to rewind the universe and see what was originally there. So if you have a piece of paper, and shred it, it's still technically possible to put the pieces back together and retrieve the information on it. Even if you burn the paper, collect all the ashes, bury it in a shallow grave and never speak of it again, you could still technically retrieve the information if you knew the exact quantum mechanical details of all the intervening processes. So it is with all information, including the information describing the particles that are falling into the black hole. Now, if information falls into a black hole, that's fine. It's stored in the black hole and it doesn't go anywhere. Except that there's a problem. That problem is Hawking radiation. Now, if you've never heard of Hawking radiation, it might be a little bit difficult to get your head around unless you take the time to understand it. But I'll have a go here anyway. First, you have to accept that pairs of particles spontaneously appear out of the vacuum of space, and then spontaneously annihilate each other across all of space and all of time. Now, it's weird, but it's true. We've shown this happens, and we can demonstrate it happens using the Casimir effect. Then you have to imagine that a pair of these particles spontaneously pops into existence on the event horizon of a black hole. And before they can annihilate each other, one gets sucked into the black hole, while the other escapes. Now, the escaping particles borrowed energy from the vacuum of space around the black hole, and it needs to give it back somehow. And it does that by taking a little bit of energy from the black hole, and by E equals mc squared, that takes away a little bit of the black hole's mass. So the black hole gradually shrinks one particle at a time. And here's the problem. Eventually the black hole will disappear. It'll evaporate. But what's happened to the information that fell into it? Has it gone? Well, no one really knows. It may be relativistically stored on the horizon of the black hole and escape with the Hawking radiation. But problems occur once a certain fraction of that information is leaked out. Either way, there's a problem. If the information disappears, that means that quantum mechanics is incomplete. If it doesn't disappear, that means that general relativity is incomplete. So solving the problem has major implications for fundamental physics. And you might think this is all very esoteric and doesn't matter. But if general relativity itself wasn't discovered a century ago, modern GPS navigation would be an impossibility. And who knows what our great-grandchildren might be missing out on if we don't understand this next key piece of physics.
Okay, so the next and final question comes from Paul Stevenson. Given the confirmation from NASA of liquid water on Mars, is it time to revisit the results of the Viking lander test back in 1976? I understand the mass spectrometer used to confirm the findings was much less sensitive than the experiment intended to test for microbial life.
Well, the question of whether there's life on Mars has excited both scientists and the public alike since Schiaparelli first noticed his channels in the Red Planet. Back in 1877. It's a key question that has major implications. If life arose on two different planets in the same solar system, it astronomically increases the chances that life is present elsewhere in the universe. I've even got a textbook from the 1960s that unequivocally states that there is life on Mars and soliloquizes about its inhabitants. But by the time we flew past Mars in 1965, it was abundantly clear that the little green men just weren't there. The main problem is that the Martian atmosphere just isn't thick enough. It's been just that little bit less dense that needs to sustain liquid water. Water can only exist on the Martian surface as either solid ice or steam, and without liquid water there can be no life, at least life we would recognise. Worse still, without a protective magnetosphere, Mars's surface is subject to much harder radiation than we would find on Earth. So even though the mass spectrometer and other instruments aboard Viking weren't that great, there's probably still little point looking for life in that data, or in any other surface mission. So there's no life on Mars. But there is still a faint glimmer of hope that there might be life in Mars. Beneath the surface, pressures are higher, and aquifers might exist. It's still not entirely proven whether the streaks seen in some craters are evidence that thermal springs are working their way to the surface. It's a strong possibility, and we won't know for certain until we go there and sample one. Their existence suggests that there is still some notable hydrological or hydrothermal activity on Mars, despite the lack of surface water and plate tectonics. And these deposits may be able to tell us if there's life on Mars now. So one possibility is to go there, to these hydrologically active sites, and dig down under the surface to see what's there. But most scientists aren't hopeful, and the ones controlling the budget would rather look for the fossilized signatures of ancient life from back in the most ancient times of Mars when it still had surface water, and to understand why Earth thrived while Mars desiccated. That information's more likely to exist. It could still answer the same questions, but broadening our understanding of the evolution of planets,